From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our Southwest Bureau. Today on the program, we are talking about opioid addiction and its effect on our community here in the Cooley region and the surrounding areas. We're joined by an expert panel of guests who have both personal and professional experience in these areas, and I'll introduce everybody right now. First, Al Bliss is with us. He's a health educator with the La Crosse County Health Department, and he's the staff lead there for Alliance to Heal. Dr. Anna Kelly is with us from Gunderson Health System. She is an expert in the treatment of addiction, and she is also a person who has been open about her own journey of recovery. Dr. Chris Eberlein is with us also from Gunderson Health System. He's an emergency and urgent care physician, and he's part of the Alliance to Heal, along with Al. Tony Van Kirk joins us as well from the Cooley Recovery Center. She is a peer recovery coach, and we'll talk to her about what that means and how she has used her experiences to help clients and others as well. Thank you all for joining us. I will jump right into the questions, just setting up the issue. Al, we've talked before in preparation for this conversation about just what a pervasive issue opioid addiction tends to be in the Cooley region, even though a lot of people might not necessarily see it in people on a day-to-day basis. How big an issue is this opioid addiction here in our area?
Right. Well, it is a big issue. And in fact, it's probably become one of the biggest issues that we've seen, especially during the pandemic at this time, related to substance use in one's mental health. I would say in 2013, we began what was called the Heroin Task Force. And the Criminal Justice Management Council out of the county had asked us to see if we could come up with 4 to 6 recommendations just to address the heroin overdose deaths. And at that time, there was 9 drug overdose deaths occurring in our county. And we thought we had peaked at 2017. We had 29 drug overdose deaths, and a lot of them were related to the prescription opioids, but also, illicit opioids, heroin, the illicit fentanyl, methamphetamine, et cetera. And unfortunately, at this time, as of October 16th, we've had the most drug overdose deaths that we have seen in our region at 32. And so it is quite an issue. There's also the non-fatal hospitalizations from opioids as well that we're seeing.
In terms of this year versus previous years, you talked about how COVID-19 and its related impacts on our society are having an effect on the issue of opioid addiction. How does this year compare to previous years? Was there a positive trend and then this year kind of messed that all up, or what's going on?
Yeah, exactly. I would say the CDC, Centers for Disease Control, came out with the guidelines for prescribing opioids. And Dr. Eberlein and Dr. Kelly can speak to this probably more intelligently than myself. But, there was 12 main guidelines that came out. And this was in 2016. And about a year or so later, we moved from the Heroin Task Force to Alliance to Heal, or Halting the Effects of Addiction Locally. And what that did was that provided us a connection with both healthcare systems, the La Crosse Community Foundation, and the health department. It provided resources and additional dollars for our community. But most importantly, it also connected us with community leaders. And they were able to help us look at systems level types of changes, so they've accomplished quite a bit of that within the healthcare system. And based on these recommendations that came out from the Centers for Disease Control in 2016. So to answer to your question is, we actually saw a decrease in the drug overdose deaths for a period of, a couple of years, And then we've experienced COVID in the early part of the year, we started to see an increase of both non-fatal and fatal overdoses.
Dr. Eberlein, death is one thing, but there are other ways for a life to be affected by addiction and for families to be affected by a loved one facing addiction. Do we have an idea, other than looking at how many people are dying from drug overdose, how pervasive the issue of opioid addiction is?
Yeah, we have some ancillary data on that. Obviously, the the overdose deaths are the easiest to track. But you know, we have clearly seen a substantial increase in mental health difficulty over the course of the last 8 months, secondary to the pandemic and all the associated problems with it. The social isolation, economic loss, all of those have really played into a perfect storm with this. And what Al mentioned, I think, is pretty important, because in 2016, up until this year, that was our highest dose, our highest rate of overdose deaths. And in the Cooley region, you know, we had taken a lot of the CDC recommendations, and the healthcare systems worked really hard on doing things like improving prescribing practices and educating providers. And we were working on improving treatment options for our patients. And then, and we actually saw a reduction. We were one of the few areas in the whole state that saw a reduction in overdose deaths over the last 3 years until this year. And so this year, it really is a dramatic increase. And we went from 29 in 2016. Last year, we were down to 22 overdose deaths. Of that, zero of them were prescription overdose deaths. And so that was another big improvement that we had made in our community. And then in the last year, you know, we've really seen that flip around, and you know, for the worst, obviously. And as of early October, we are already up to 32 overdose deaths, and you know, there's several pending, so we're expecting this number to be close to 40 by the time the year is up.
So Al was talking a little bit earlier just about how COVID-19, what numbers have been affected since we've seen COVID-19 take an effect. Dr. Kelly, why don't I come to you with this question? In terms of what's going on in somebody's mind or in their experiences, what is it about something like the effects of COVID-19 that might trigger that kind of addictive behavior in somebody who either hadn't experienced it before or might have had it under control?
That's a very good question. But before I answer it, I wanted to comment on a couple things that have been that we've talked about already. I did want to mention, and I'm sure you've seen this, Dr. Eberline, and we do a lot of urine tests up here, kind of like forensic analysis of, you know, what's actually out there on the streets. Before COVID hit us early in the year 2020, over the past couple of years, we've seen just a huge increase in fentanyl analogs, along with a almost complete absence of what we know as heroin, which is 6-acetylmorphine. And so, you know, it's actually been in looking at the urines that I saw this trend before COVID. And so we were already beginning to see just a more severe form of the disease. It was very hard to get people transitioned as quickly as we had seen with heroin. It's a fairly straightforward thing to transition someone from heroin to buprenorphine or Suboxone. With the new fentanyl analogs, about a year and a half ago, I began to struggle with sort of this protracted withdrawal. And so I don't want to blame all of the uptick in overdose deaths and other comorbidities on COVID, although that certainly has had an effect. You know, I've been out at work every day. If I'd had to stay at home or do virtual visits from home, I think I would have struggled greatly with that. So just the change in routine is one thing. Being isolated. There's a line in AA that says we are isolated and alone in self-constructed prisons. And then combine that with being physically isolated, you know, in my home or in my room, it's difficult. We, you know, humans are social animals. Also, you know, the headlines have been pretty scary over the past 8 months. Not knowing, you know, which websites to look at. We're hardwired to pay attention to, you know, things that might kill us. That's a sort of long-winded answer to your question, but also touching on the problem of the fentanyl analogs mostly coming from China and easily ordered on the internet, you know, either the precursor for the fentanyl analogs or the drug itself. The RAND report, of 2019 highlighted the number of drug seizures at the border. And for example, the number of fentanyl analogs that, you know, heretofore we weren't testing for absolutely exploded between 2017 and now, or 2019, and I'm sure it's further increased. And so the drug landscape is changing even before COVID hit. And I just want to highlight that I think that's a problem that isn't going to go away when, for example, when the COVID vaccines, you know, when most of our population's vaccinated and things are, quote, you know, back to normal. Sure. And if it's okay, I'd like to comment on one other thing that you had touched on earlier, that it is a family disease. And, you know, if you ask around in different groups, there's almost no audience of, you know, 50 to 100 people that I'm talking to on this topic that don't raise their hand if I ask, if you or anyone close to you has a problem with addiction, please raise your hand. Almost the entire audience will raise their hand. You know, this has been a problem since the beginning of humanity. Most people who use drugs are rarely faithful to one drug. So I know we're talking about the opioid crisis because we're losing a lot of young people, you know, and losing a lot of human capital. But it's really a brain disease that's been with us since the beginning of humanity. For each person with opioid use disorder that walks in the clinic here, there's about 15 others that have a problem with alcohol. And so it's really not a problem with any particular drug or another, although it might seem that way. It's really a brain disease and, you know, can be a little bit disheartening for us to talk. But I always say, you know, recovery is possible. And Gunderson's and other healthcare systems focus on helping people get into real recovery is moving to me. You know, there is a solution. That's what I want to say.
Yeah. An important aspect of the conversation to bring up. And certainly as our conversation continues, we're going to talk about what some of those solutions options are for people. Dr. Anna Kelly there from Gunderson Health System, also joined by her colleague, Dr. Chris Eberline. Tony Van Kirk is with us from the Cooley Recovery Center. Tony, I promise we're going to get to you very soon. We've been hearing also from Al Bliss, who is with the La Crosse County Health Department and involved with the Alliance to Heal. It all continues as Newsmakers continues. You can find out more about our program on our website, which is wpr.org/newsmakers. That's where you can stream on demand previous episodes of our program, or you can contact us if you have a question or a show you'd like to hear in the future. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall in La Crosse, and we're joined by a panel of people talking about opioid addiction today. And in fact, hearing a very fervent reminder from Dr. Anna Kelly moments ago on how opioid addiction is the subject of the day, but addiction as a broader category of conversation, certainly important. And there are aspects of this conversation that are applicable across the board as far as that is concerned. Dr. Kelly is from Gunderson Health System. We're also joined by Dr. Chris Eberline of Gunderson Health System and Al Bliss from La Crosse County. And Tony Van Kirk is a peer recovery coach at the Cooley Recovery Center. And that's where I'd like to begin. Tony, I was hoping that you could tell us a little bit about the work that you do as a peer recovery coach. What does that mean for people who are not familiar with that term?
First, we have to be in recovery ourselves, which is a major part of my story. Is I'm in recovery from several bouts with opioids and methamphetamine. But just being able to be there for the individuals that have overdosed or are struggling with addiction, that just want to get help and just don't know where to go. We're there to help them navigate the system, connect them with meetings, anything we can to help these people to get healthy and have a normal life.
You talked about what qualifies you to be a peer recovery coach is that you're actually a peer of these people and you're in recovery. Tell us about your story. How did you find yourself on that road to recovery?
I had to do an incarceration, but during that incarceration, I had decided I just couldn't take it no more, and I had to change. I had a family. I had to be somebody different than what I was. When I looked in the mirror, I wasn't happy. It was a horrible feeling. And for most of my life, I struggled with addiction. I just didn't know where to go. I did get help at one point. I had a car accident, so the doctor kind of prescribed a lot of medication for me, and that's where it all started. And it was just a downward spiral from there, and just realizing that one day I can't take it no more, and it's not who I was. So struggling every day.
So addiction had been a bit of a lifelong issue for you. Was this when did you start to experience it as something about yourself that you wished that you could change?
Back in high school, just after the football game on Friday nights, we'd all go and have a drink, and that's where it all started for me. Just, you know, I lived in a small town, and that there was really nothing to do, and that was our Friday nights, and that's where it started for me.
Dr. Kelly, you also have been open about your the issues in your past, and I'm wondering if you would mind recounting you know what part of your story you think it might be important for people to hear in this context.
Okay, well, yeah, I am. I would say recovery. I've been in recovery 22 years, a little over 22 years, and I would say that it changed the trajectory of my life, and it changed the trajectory of my children's lives. In fact, I think my last patient today asked me a little bit about that, and we got to talking about how I knew, you know, before I was ready to get in recovery, nothing could make me, you know, no employer, no spouse, no parent, no family member, no good friend. You know, I just wasn't ready. What I was doing, you know, was working for me. I was drinking primarily on the weekends. You know, I'm working 50, 60 hours a week. Don't tell me I have a problem. You know, this is working for me. And then there came a time in my life, I was 35, you know, when I got in recovery, where the as my 12-step sponsor says, I began to lower my behavior quicker than I could lower my standards, you know. So under the influence of alcohol and other drugs, I found myself saying things to close friends and family and neighbors that I wouldn't normally say, or doing things that I wouldn't normally do. So there became a wider and wider gap in my values, what I said I believed in, and how I was actually living. And that became a very painful condition, you know, internally. And that's when I reached out for help. I actually had to go live in a residential treatment center for 4 months. My children were 3 and 5. You know, I'm sure you've heard, I was just sick and tired of being sick and tired, you know. And I did the 5 things that they ask us to do in AA: call your sponsor every day, go to lots of meetings, lots of 12-step meetings, you know, work the steps with my sponsor, work with others is vital to permanent recovery, and then have a daily dedication to staying sober that day. So I actually don't drink or use drugs, you know, one day at a time. I have a funny story. When my daughter just got married in Charleston, South Carolina, a couple months ago, and this friend of mine was saying, you know, well, Anna, this is about 6 months before I admitted I had a problem and went to treatment. She said, Anna, can't you go to treatment? I said, no, I can't go to treatment. I might, you know, I might lose my medical license. I'll probably lose my job. I'll lose my husband. I'll lose the kids in the house. I can't go. And then because she was a friend, I was so bold as to say the next line. I said, you know, besides, I might want to have a drink at Hannah's wedding. And my friend Susan said, well, how old is she? I said, she's 4, you know. So I was just the thought of never taking another drink or a mood and mind altering drug, you know, if I needed it, you know, was bothersome to me. And I found out, you know, when I went to treatment, it's just a one day at a time thing. And, you know, and then 22 years have passed between that time and this. So that's a little how I, you know, came to be in the rooms of AA. And actually I changed careers at that point. And I worked in anesthesia for a few more years, but I started working with patients that had addiction and other chronic problems such as chronic pain. I was a de-prescriber of opioids in Atlanta for the couple decades before I came up here, you know, right when all my colleagues were prescribing more and more opioids, you know, for people who weren't doing well on them or needed to get off or needed to go to treatment. That's kind of how I got into the professional field of addiction medicine.
Do you find that your experience in that area of, on the personal side of your own struggles helps you as a doctor, helps you as a person who's working with people who are facing these issues?
I think it does. I have an understanding of the suffering that so many patients feel. I have a number of patients I'm seeing with other problems with other substances, alcohol being the big one here in this area. La Crosse is the sixth most drunken city in the United States, according to some polls. You know, I'm sure, Dr. Eberlein, you've seen this. People don't want to be making a mess of their lives with drugs and alcohol, you know, but there comes a point when they're in that, when the midbrain's been hijacked and they're in that using withdrawal craving cycle, they just can't get out of it without professional help. So I understand where people are along those stages of change, you know, because like I said, until I was ready, nothing could make me. But when I was ready, you know, almost nothing could stop me. You know, I was going to find a way to relieve my suffering one way or the other, and recovery, you know, 12-step recovery is what did it. So yes, I think it helps. I think people enjoy having a safe place, you know, to talk about it. I mean, you know, sometimes the response of the world is, you know, quit doing that, you know, but I mean, if I could have quit doing it, I would have, you know. And so I just try to extend understanding and you know, motivate people to get to where they want to be. They don't want to be living like this. You know, many of them, they just, you know, their brain has, there's a portion of the midbrain that's, you know, totally hijacked by drugs and alcohol. And until that process is interrupted and then treatment ensues, you know, they're just almost doomed to continue to do it. So, you know, and I try to meet people where they are and then pull them along that stages of change just a little bit, you know, with each visit that I have with them.
Dr. Eberlein, when you're bringing people to the understanding that they might have an addiction problem, or when somebody is looking at a loved one wondering if their addiction issue is whether they have an addiction problem or whether they just use either a prescription-based product or alcohol or something like that. I guess since we're talking about opioids specifically on today's show, maybe we make it about that. How do you teach people to recognize addiction when they see it?
Well, you know, that's a good question and a difficult one sometimes from an emergency department standpoint, because we often see people when they are truly at their worst. You know, typically when we're dealing with the addiction component of this, it's someone who's brought back from a significant overdose, a near fatal overdose. And getting to Dr. Kelly's point about the potency of these drugs, you know, about 5 years ago, 5 to 10 years ago, the standard dose of Narcan was 0.4 milligrams. We start at 4 milligrams now. So it's been a 10-time escalation in dosage of Narcan to try to wake these patients up. And sometimes that's not even enough. So really, anytime anyone comes in, fortunately, oftentimes when they have overdosed and we brought them back with Narcan, they're willing to start the discussion with a provider about their addiction, because it's kind of that clarity moment for them. And that's why it's so important to have resources available when these patients come into the emergency department after an overdose. And that's really something that I've been focusing hard on working and getting throughout our community, because these patients, sometimes your window of opportunity is short. And so the peer recovery coaches have been really helpful. Prior to COVID, you know, they would actually come in the emergency department. They were on call and they would meet with these patients. And that was really instrumental for a lot of them, because they need someone they can connect with. And that was really an important aspect of getting them to agree to take the next step and hopefully follow up with someone like Dr. Kelly to take those steps to get better.
When you talk about trying to direct people toward resources that are available, there are some kinds of things that are available in our area and some things that you might have to go farther afield to find. What is sort of the first step for somebody who thinks they might need help?
You know, it's a very complicated issue, first off, to address. There's many entry points where someone can go to get help. And one of the biggest issues that I see is I feel like we are resource-rich with, you know, our recovery center, our healthcare systems, 5 medicated-assisted treatment provider agencies, but how someone navigates or the amount of time that it might take someone to get into treatment is really, I think, one of the biggest challenges. And so that's one of the reasons why Alliance to Heal formed, is to try to look at how that might be better navigated and have an improvement, and then linking all of the agencies together. And this reminds me of what came out of Vermont with the hub and spoke model with this. And so basically that is like the hub is like an opioid treatment center or provider. And then the spokes are all the different agencies that people can connect to, from treatment to, you know, recovery and follow up and all of that. So I see that is one of the biggest challenges that we face. And if you look at national survey data, as Dr. Kelly was saying, this has been around as a brain disease since since we've been around. And I would say that probably only about 10% of people usually end up seeking that help. And one out of 10 alone would meet the substance use disorder definition. So how we all work together, or how we play together, how we coordinate this together, is really one of the biggest challenges, I think. And that's something that we're trying to improve, like how individuals are identified with opioid use disorder or substance use. There's the different assessment tools that are out there, and what type of level of care that they get. And just to provide you another example, you know, not everybody needs residential treatment or inpatient treatment, where the typical stay is, you know, 28, 30 days. And sometimes I think, as Dr. Kelly was saying, she was in inpatient treatment for 4 months. So there's different levels of that. Not everybody needs that, but one of the closest places in our region, unfortunately, is either Chippewa Falls with Ellie Phillips or Tellurian in Madison. And so that's a challenge. You know, the county has comprehensive community services, which is wraparound services available to connect them to, you know, social workers and other services to help them. But one of the barriers is it's challenging to get enrolled into that within a timely manner. So another way to put that is, when today's your day, you want to be able to get help. And there's potential, there's capacity, we're resource rich, but that doesn't always happen. And so I'm going to say that, you know, Tony is like one of the angels in our community. When you think of peer recovery coaches, someone that can do a warm handoff and help them make each of those steps is so vital. I mean, when you're in recovery or you're in treatment, it's probably very difficult to think about managing your day, let alone working and so forth.
That's Al Bliss. He is with the La Crosse County Health Department and is the staff lead for Alliance to Heal. We're also speaking today with Dr. Chris Eberlein and Dr. Anna Kelly, both of Gunderson Health System, and Tony Van Kirk, a peer recovery coach with the Cooley Recovery Center. Our conversation continues in just a moment. We'll be talking about how to either get into recovery or more information about how to help someone toward recovery, if that's in fact what they need. And that's all coming up on Newsmakers. Our website, once again, is wpr.org/newsmakers. If you are into podcasts, you can find us on many of your favorite podcasting platforms. Just open them up, search for Newsmakers, and hit subscribe. We would greatly appreciate the attention there. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall in our Southwest Bureau, and we're talking about opioid addiction today. We have a panel of expert guests with us, which includes Al Bliss from the County Health Department in La Crosse, Dr. Charles... Dr. Chris Eberline from Gunderson Health System. He is an emergency and urgent care physician there. He's also a part of Alliance to Heal. Al is the staff lead for Alliance to Heal, and Dr. Eberline is a board member with that organization. Tony Van Kirk is with us, also a peer recovery coach from the Cooley Recovery Center. Dr. Anna Kelly has been with us on today's program as well and has had to step away, and we certainly thank her for her time. Tony, I've seen you nodding in affirmation a lot during some of Al's comments about how difficult it can be for people to navigate this web of different treatment options that we have in our area, which might be appropriate for them, and exactly how do they gain access to it. What's your advice for somebody who knows that they need to seek treatment and doesn't know what to do?
You always, for surely, reach out to somebody. If you don't know, reach out, ask, because there's never easy answers for that. But going to like the Cooley Recovery Center, we're there. We have a drop-in center. It's staffed with recovery coaches, but due to COVID, we're on call. But definitely, it's out there if you just ask. One good thing about COVID is we have Google and NA meetings are virtual, and you can go any time of the day. Just reaching out. You don't even have to go to the town where you're from. And that can be hard sometimes for people.
Is it a matter of just, you know, Googling, you know, where's a recovery meeting in my area? Or is there a specific website that people should be going to?
If it is alcohol, they have the AA meetings. So Alcoholics Anonymous, anywhere from Narcotics Anonymous. They have several hundreds of different kinds of anonymous meetings. So there's something there for everyone.
Dr. Eberline, how often do you find people who know that they have trouble and they just don't know how to talk about it? They don't know, they don't have the vocabulary maybe, or maybe the, I don't know, maybe are embarrassed to talk to somebody about it or something like that. How hard is it to get that conversation started?
I think it can be very difficult for a lot of patients to make that initial step. It can be a very complicated system to navigate, and helping these patients navigate this system to find the right fit for them. Because the one thing that you quickly realize as you take care of these patients that one type of treatment does not fit all. And it's really important that you align them with what they need for treatment. And unfortunately, sometimes it's hit, you know, it's trial and error too. The important thing is you keep trying and you keep working with them to navigate the rather in the healthcare system be complicated in general. And then when you complicate things with addiction, and then sometimes their financial barriers and other barriers start getting thrown up in front of these patients to get them to where they need to go, can be quite a challenge.
How do you help people understand how to notice that they have a problem?
Oftentimes it's just that communication. And then, you know, from a physician standpoint, you know, in the ER, they come in, if they've overdosed, it's fairly straightforward. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it's just a matter of talking to them about, you know, what else is going on with them. When you start to talk to them about other mental health issues, a lot of this time it just gets brought up to the surface that they have a problem and they're looking for help. The one thing I've noticed that patients are much more open to having this discussion than they were 10 years ago. There used to be much more of a stigma, and they were much more reluctant, maybe untrusting of the healthcare providers to have that conversation. I'm not finding that like it used to be. Patients now, those in recovery, they have no problem saying, you know, I really don't want a narcotic. I've struggled with this in the past, and are refusing those. Other patients will be very straightforward and say, you know, I'm having trouble with this aspect. I'm having trouble with addiction. Where can I go? And sometimes it's even after they've come in for something completely unrelated. You know, they're in there for, you know, sutures or, you know, some other complaint. When you're done taking care of them, they'll bring it up. They'll say, is there something that you can, I'm struggling with this. Where can I go? And that's when we start having more of that conversation, bringing others involved, you know, social workers, you know, the peer recovery coaches, things like that, onto the team. Because it's really a team approach to get these patients better.
Al, we used to see a lot, like in depicted in TV shows and late night or after school movies or whatever. Somebody's got a problem. Somebody else is going to stage an intervention, and here we go. It's the family come together moment. Is that a thing that is a reasonable course of action for most people if they sense a loved one having a problem, or how should someone go about approaching a loved one who they think might be in the throes of addiction?
Well, that's a great question, Ezra, and I'm not sure I'm the best qualified, certainly on this call, to answer that. And, you know, I know Tony, obviously, as a peer recovery coach and working for Cooley Recovery Center, they have programs such as Get Your Loved One Sober. There's programs for parents of those that are with addicted children and that, too. So I'm wondering if Tony might be, a lot more qualified to answer, a lot more knowledgeable about that. But I just like to say this before I go here is that, it's amazing how it impacts people of all different socioeconomic status levels and everything. And that's one of the biggest changes I think I've seen in our community. It's improving on the level of stigma. But it still have long ways to go.
Tony, to Al's point, what about approaching a loved one who is having difficulty that they're having trouble admitting?
I think, just being honest with them, always keep being, upfront and not in a confrontational way, but, telling them that you feel you have a problem and directing them, to possible meet with somebody, about their issues. And there's always groups, like Al said, for families. And I definitely encourage that because nobody knows better what you're going through than somebody who's also going through the same things.
So what kind of success numbers do we see in terms of people who find their way into recovery and really are able to find a meaningful, different way to live?
I think there's actually, if people really work the recovery, there's high numbers. You have to be willing to want to change. And if they go to the meetings or if that doesn't work for them, just doing what works for them, if they work that program, it works.
Dr. Eberlein, has that been your experience? How often do you see somebody, how many times does it take for somebody to start a recovery process and then finally find a way through it that has a lasting impact for them?
Yeah, I mean, it's really variable per patient, but that is one thing that you really have to emphasize is that there are a lot of patients that have fully recovered, and sometimes people think that it doesn't happen, but it does. There's a lot of very productive people that have fully recovered from addiction, and they are working, contributing members to society, and living productive, healthy lives. And so for everyone that we can get in through that is a real win for all of us.
We're talking about opioid addiction here on today's program. But as you can imagine, a lot of that conversation about addiction is really applicable across the board. And so we've enjoyed visiting with our guests today, who are Dr. Chris Eberlein, who you just heard from Gunderson Health System, Tony Van Kirk, a peer recovery coach with the Cooley Recovery Center, Al Bliss from the La Crosse County Health Department. And our conversation continues. We've got another segment right around the corner with our guests today. If you'd like to stream this episode or any other episode on demand, you can do so at our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. That's where you can get in touch with us as well if you have a question for a follow-up program. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our studios in La Crosse, and joining me are Al Bliss from La Crosse County Health Department, Tony Van Kirk, a peer recovery coach with Cooley Recovery Center, and Dr. Chris Eberlein of Gunderson Health System. And we're talking about opioid addiction and the various forms that it takes and the various ways that people find their way into recovery. One thing that we've heard mentioned a few times on the show is the idea of a medication-assisted recovery. And that, I think, you don't hear so much in the conversations where people are talking about going to meetings, or you don't think of it, even though it would be part of certain kinds of residential treatment programs, you don't think about that in those terms. But Dr. Eberlein, just talk about if somebody feels like they might be a candidate for medically assisted recovery, or that they might need that. Who do they reach out to make that inquiry?
That's a great question. There are lots of avenues and lots of different MAT, medication assisted treatment programs out there. And I think you really need to work with a provider or a mental health professional to figure out what is your best route and which one would be a good fit for you. So the initial reach out, I think, would be if you have a primary care provider, to be to that person, or a social worker or someone involved in any of the treatment programs. There are several in our community, and they all have intake numbers that you could reach out to. And I believe they're all listed on our Alliance to Heal website as well.
So in terms of the way that we've changed the way we look at opioids and the use of opioids in treatment, and we certainly know a lot more about how quickly people can become addicted to them, Dr. Eberlein, just as a physician who's been around this issue for a while, what changes have you seen in the way that opioids are used in medical treatment, you know, in terms of just the addictive nature of them?
It's really changed a lot. In early on, you know, 20 years ago, there was a real big shift to treat just about all pain with opioids. And we've quickly realized that, one, they're actually not as effective as we thought they'd be for acute pain. And two, the initial thought was that they weren't as addictive as they actually are. So we really shifted to, when patients need opiates for pain, short prescriptions, no refills, and close follow-up to make sure they're not having trouble with these medications. And even before you go towards the opioids, look at other ways you can treat their pain, whether it be, you know, in the ORs, they're using longer local anesthetics. They need less post-operative pain medication. They're looking at nerve blocks rather than systemic opioids. Physical therapy early on in your course, dry needle therapy, acupuncture, chiropractic care. You know, there's all these other treatment modalities. And the reality is a lot of them do take a little more time than prescribing a pill, and more time on the patient's part. But in the end, it's much better for the patient. They're actually getting oftentimes much better pain control, and you're actually you're doing more healing than covering up the pain. And that's the important part.
I think that the idea of the effectiveness of opioids not being as high as once thought would be surprising to people, because I remember when we as journalists started covering this issue maybe 6, 8, 9 years ago, something like that, you would ask questions like, you know, well, the opioid is obviously more effective, but why shouldn't patients be taking it right away? But you're saying that in some cases it isn't even as effective.
Yeah, there's been some good studies now that show the ibuprofen and Tylenol acetaminophen taken together are much more effective for pain control than the short-acting opioids. For dental pain is what one of the big studies was, or orthopedic pain. So, yeah, it has been shown that it's actually better to take these other medications, and they have much fewer side effects.
Tony Van Kirk, you're a person who is in recovery, and you are also a recovery coach, helping people through their own recovery process. What do you wish someone had been able to tell you? You talked about your first experience with opioids being after a car accident. You were prescribed it. Looking back, what do you wish that you would have known, or what do you wish your doctor might have known at that time?
Just how addicting they are, and to try to just stop taking them. It's so hard. It was probably the worst feeling I've ever felt in my life. And being on such a strong dose, it was just horrible. It was a nightmare. So just letting people know about the possibilities of the addiction and taking them for long term.
When we look at all the different policies around it, the recommendations have certainly changed as to how often and how much opioids are prescribed. There are new tracking systems that are in place. There are all kinds of legal things on a state-by-state basis, even nationally. What are some of the policy discussions that are going on now? I don't know if Dr. Eberlein or Al, you might be able to answer this. Whoever wants to take it first. What are some of the policy discussions that are going on now about what needs to be the next step in policy to decrease the addiction to opioid and the use of opioids in our society?
What's important to understand is there's Representative Nygren up in the northern part of Wisconsin that recently passed over the past 4 years, 30 different bills related to opioids, and they've related to funding and reimbursing peer recovery coaches, to Narcan, to Good Samaritan Response, to provide some immunity for those that are still maybe under the influence but are helping someone in the case of an overdose. And I think that that's been an amazing bipartisan effort in our state. And I would say that those are continuing to be looked at. We actually do have a policy work group, but unfortunately during this pandemic, we have not been very active. One of the things that I just learned today was that the State Division of Health Services is now looking at potentially how they can have the reporting of methadone and Suboxone put on what's called the, you know, the prescription drug monitoring program, because right now they're exempt from having to list that on there. And although I would say, looking at our toxicology reports of those that have passed, the ones that contain methadone or Suboxone are quite small. There are definitely some cases. And so it's possible, you know, that people certainly can abuse methadone and Suboxone, but I think that that might help also gather a little bit more insight. So that's just one example. Another one is with the Division of Health Services, the statutes that govern, treatment and the amount of reimbursement. Those, they've had public forums for those, and they want to look at how they can improve that. And without getting into a lot of detail, nor am I probably the right person to talk about those, you know, regulations, but those are definitely some things that I've seen in the past and some things that I think still need to be considered. But, you know, I know Dr. Eberlein's been involved with many healthcare, systems level changes. I mean, at both Gunderson and Mayo here, that's been really an improvement for what's been happening. And so, you know, certainly hats off to both healthcare systems for reducing the amount of prescription opioids that are present. So that's definitely been an enormous improvement. And so I believe that they keep the metrics of on about 12, they report on about 12 different things that are related to opioid prescribing.
Dr. Eberlein, what about those tools that are in your arsenal as a doctor on a policy level? What would you like to see as next steps in terms of opioid treatment?
So, a few small things improving there's still improvements you made in the prescription drug monitoring program. We talked about this earlier today. A lot of the medication assisted treatment program drugs are not mandatory to be entered, which I think would be helpful. Plus, I think we're beyond the time where we need to separate those out. I think it just adds to the stigma of the disease when you treat it separately. You know, we're always treating it special, but then we're saying that we need to eliminate the stigma. That's kind of double speak, and I think we really need to take a look at that and treat it like a mental health organic disease, and not treat it special. So that would be the first thing I'd look at. Continuing funding for treatment programs at work. You know, we really have to keep researching this, keep putting the research dollars into the basic science and understanding the brain better. We've got a ways to go. We've made a lot of improvements in the last 10 years on understanding addiction, but it's a complicated disease, and we have to keep working at that.
Dr. Eberlein, I want to thank you for participating in the show today. I want to thank the rest of our guests as well, Tony Van Kirk, Dr. Anna Kelly, who had to leave a little bit earlier, and Al Bliss, all have been kind enough to join us. Thank you all very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Indeed. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall in La Crosse. Our producers are John Davis and Dawn Jewell, and I thank them for their assistance today. If you'd like to hear this program again or stream any of our programs on demand, you can do so at our website. That's WPR.org/newsmakers. There are a few opportunities each week to catch the show. We originate, of course, on Friday mornings at 10 on the Ideas Network. You can find our repeat on Friday evenings at 7 on La Crosse's WLSU 88.9. And you can get up early with us on Saturday, 5 a.m. on WLSU 88.9 as well. Until next week, this is Ezra Wall. Please join us again for another Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio.